This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hello there, and thank you, Parker. I'm your host, Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. Way back in Season 2, Episode 31, we spoke to our next guest for the first time. It was a fun chat, but back in those days, we had a hard limit of around 27 minutes per episode, which in most cases is pretty good for a podcast, but I've found that many of my guests have far too many stories to shave down to an arbitrary number, so I've shaken off the shackles of time limits, and now I let my guests run with their stories. I mean, that's what Time Signatures is all about. And so, let's get to it. Our guest has had an incredible career spanning more than 50 years. His biggest claim to fame is the gig he held as a guitarist with the late legendary blues man Muddy Waters from 1973 to 1980. He went on to form his own band, and he's been keeping the blues alive ever since. He has played with the veritable who's who in the blues, including Johnny Winter and many, many more. Let's get him in here with his stories. One of my personal favorites, Steady Roland, Bob Margolin. Welcome back to Time Signatures. How are you, sir?
Glad to be here. Thank you. I've been home lately and enjoying very much my home sweet home with my wife and my pets and everything. And
yeah,
but I love to get to talk about the blues music that we love. And I've been posting a lot about it on Facebook while I'm home and telling a lot of my old stories and publishing a lot of articles that I wrote a long time ago. And it's from the comfort of home, it's bringing me to blues music fans all over the world that way. And
yes, indeed,
I enjoy that very much.
You know, I got to tell you, I picked up a copy of Steady Roland, the ebook that you published a couple of years ago, and absolutely love that. I actually used the book as part of my preparation for this interview, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being back with us at Time Signatures. Following our first interview, I followed you on social media. I'm one of those guys that's been doing that. And you guys, yeah, I'm telling you, man, you've got some stories out there. So today, my goal is to help get some of those stories on the record, so to speak, with your assistance. Now, I'd like to start with your love for Muddy, and I'd like to begin back in August 1973. Could you share the circumstances that led to you playing on his bandstand?
By August of 1973, I was in a band called the Boston Blues Band. And we had opened some shows for Muddy Waters, who was my favorite musician ever since I heard him in the 1960s. So actually to be around him and be on shows with him and have him hear our band, while I had plenty of opportunity to hang with him and hear his band, That was a thrill for me. On a Tuesday, I believe it was, I went to see Muddy play at a club called Paul's Mall in Boston, which is the town where I live. And as it happened, I was the first one in the club. Now, the first person that I saw when I walked in was the harmonica player. His name, as Muddy introduced him, was George Mojo Dreamy-Eyed, Good-Looking Buford. And he was all those things. And when I saw him, he asked a question that I expected. Got any reefer? And I did. That was the That was what musicians did for each other on the road. Would you know, little bag of something to smoke and help them relax. But then he completely surprised me. He said, "Oh, Muddy just fired Sammy, his guitar player, last night. Wait here." And before I could say anything, he went back in the dressing room. Muddy Waters himself came out of the dressing room and he said, "Oh, good. Come to my hotel room tomorrow and bring a guitar." He had seen me play, and our band was just smart enough not to do Muddy Waters songs on a gig where Muddy himself was there. We didn't do "Got My Mojo Working" or "Hoochie Coochie Man" or anything like that. Although we did those things when we were just doing regular gigs that he wasn't around for. But I've been playing some Elmore James style slide guitar, some Jimmy Rogers, Jimmy Reed, just the usual suspects of Chicago blues. And it was, I could see what was happening right in the moment. He was interested in perhaps taking me into the band. And I realized I was at the crossroads of my life with what I did with the opportunity. So I came by his hotel room the next day. I did not have an acoustic guitar, but I brought an electric guitar and a fairly small amplifier. It was a Fender Deluxe amp, which is like a small suitcase that you could bring. I brought it into Muddy's room and plugged it in. I said, "Is this the kind of amplifier you guys used in the 1950s?" Because it was a 1950s amp. And he goes, "Yeah." Just it was not like he was imparting history. I just asked him a casual question about an amplifier, and he answered it. And I had him scoped out pretty good for what he might want me to do. I took out the guitar, and he said, "Play it," and I was ready. I played a slow blues in the style that I followed from watching him, just a slow blues in E, just straight Chicago blues. But then I had the amazing thrill after I played the little turnaround of what I was playing and got to where a first verse would be. Muddy started singing.
Oh, wow.
And this was in a hotel room. He just sang some blues. And after a little while, he called his girlfriend in and said, "Hey, listen to this kid play my shit. And go ahead, do it again." It wasn't like he had discovered a great guitar player, because he knew and was a great guitar player. But it was more like a puppy doing a trick. And go ahead, play it again. Go ahead. And did it again. See, that's my shit. And he said, "Okay, we'll give it a chance. You can start tomorrow." And I said to him, "Well, I've got gigs with the band that I'm in," which he knew the band, and he knew where we were playing too. It's a club called the Shabu Inn in Willimantic, Connecticut, which was a college town, and he used to play there, and the band I was in got to play there. I fully expected he would say, "Well, you got to start tomorrow. I need someone tomorrow." But he didn't do that. He said, "Okay, you can start on Sunday." And so I got to finish out the week with my band, but with the promise from Muddy Waters that he was gonna at least try me out with his band. And so all week long, the people in the band I was in were congratulating me and said, "Oh, you're a star now." And I said, I haven't got the gig, and when I get the gig, I have to do as good as I can do with it. So that's what I intended to do, and it did work out that way. And Muddy did give me a chance to play with the band, and I tried to do everything I could do to be helpful to him on and off the bandstand. And
And go ahead, I'm
go
sorry.
ahead.
I was just going to say that had to be a massive thrill for you, because it sounds like this is something you had wanted to do all of your young life, yeah?
No, I never even dreamed of thinking that that could even happen, or that there
Wow.
might be an opportunity, or that he would want to. But it was obvious that the rest of my life was in front of me, and the exact words that were in my mind once I had the opportunity was, if I don't do this, I will be putting a cap on learning the Chicago blues music I love, because there'd never be a better place to learn it from than one of the, we call them a GOAT now, greatest of all time.
Yes, sir.
To actually learn like a apprentice to a master, rather than somebody taking lessons from even a good teacher, is very different on the bandstand. And he had the lessons to impart, and I certainly dedicated myself to learning them and using what I learned to give him the music that he wanted from me on the bandstand, and then to be able to use it for myself when I made my own music.
You know, I absolutely love that you have that opportunity so early in life. Another of your posts that you posted about Muddy talked about the love blues fans have for Muddy's Hard Again album. You said that Johnny's production is one of the most distinctive and attractive features of the album. Talk about that for a moment, would you please?
I did that. Johnny Winter, who I had seen in the 60s when he started to get well known. I have a nice picture I took of him in 1969 at a show in Boston. And then I met him in 1974 at a PBS special that was a tribute to Muddy, and it had Johnny Winter there, as well as Dr. John, Coco Taylor, and Willie Dixon, and
Man.
Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. They were just all, and Mike Bloomfield was there, the great guitar player that had been in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, and then he was just considered a guitar hero legend at that time. He was there, and when After Muddy played some songs with his band, Bloomfield used my amp. I was very glad to be able to do that.
I imagine.
I had met Johnny at that, and I knew how much he loved Muddy and that music. But in, well, I guess late 1976, Muddy had an announced, I'm going to make a new album, and this is going to be the first one that isn't for Chess Records. He had been on Chess Records since the early 1950s, and we had done an album the year before, which was his last one for Chess Records, called the Woodstock album, which was produced very lovingly and by Levon Helm from the band, and his friend Henry Glover, who was a producer for King Records in the early 1950s. He had written that song that Ray Charles did, "Drown in My Own Tears." I mean, these were great music people that did the Woodstock album.
Yes.
But Muddy was leaving Chess Records and gonna go with a label that Johnny's manager had. And it was called Blue Sky Records. And I asked Muddy directly. I said, "Are you okay with leaving Chess Records?" He says, "Yeah, it's totally owned by a corporation now." And he said, "There are no nobody from the Chess family is involved in it anymore." So that was interesting. But that's what he said about it.
Yeah.
Now, at the time, I guess Muddy and Johnny chose who to use on the album, and I'm grateful that they chose me to be the third guitar player on the album, which would be Muddy and Johnny Winter. We also had James Cotton was going to be the harmonica player on it, and Pinetop Perkins and Willie Big Eye Smith from Muddy's band, and me in there. When we all came into in near Westport, Connecticut, on the day before, Cotton and his bass player came from Vancouver, and me and Muddy and Pinetop flew in, I think, from Newfoundland, and got to probably well, one of the New York airports, and then rode up into Connecticut to play. Except we picked up James Cotton at the airport. Muddy had me and Willie Smith drive in to meet Cotton at his plane, and he came off the plane not ready to go to the hotel and get ready for the session the next day. He wanted to go into New York City and party all night, which we did.
Oh, man.
And about halfway through it, I said, I better let Muddy know what's going on. And I called Muddy from somebody's apartment. And Muddy started yelling at me. He's like, here's Cotton. And Cotton takes the phone, starts laughing at Muddy, and go, hey man, we're gonna make a great album. We'll see you in the morning. Click. And we stayed out late and got there, and then got up in the morning and went into the studio and set up to play. And as it turned out, Johnny had a very good conception of how he wanted to do the album. He wanted to get the old sound of a band in a room. And so he didn't mic everything really closely. He didn't use a lot of baffling to keep instruments from bleeding into other people's mics. And he did use a couple of what we call room microphones, which is microphones near the ceiling that capture the whole sound and the ambience. And he used them a lot more than most producers and engineers use those room mics.
Wow.
And it sounded like a band in a room, and people love the sound of that album. Both professional people who tell me, oh, I wish I could get my studio to sound like that. That's what I aim for. Derek Trucks told me that in about 2020 when we were talking at a gig, that he just loved that the sound of that album, and so do a lot of people. As it turned out, that album did exactly what Johnny hoped for, which is to turn people onto Muddy and his music. And it did seem like a rebirth at the end of his life. It got him a lot of recognition that he was still out there, and kind of his career had been going okay. He was playing concerts and
Yes,
all kinds of clubs, from showcase to dive bars, but he did a lot better after that.
I have to tell you, I interviewed GA20 recently, and they record very much the way you guys recorded that album. And they talked about that ambiance and just the overall sound quality. Recording in a room like that without all the baffling and the separate mics and whatnot. Looking back at this era, is it safe to say they just don't make records like they used to in most instances, Bob?
I don't know what anybody else is doing, and I'll bet there are a lot of musicians like GA20 and some of the more traditional blues musicians that want to go back and do it the old way, a band in a room. But the thing on Hard Again is we were having so much fun while we were playing, and it came through in the microphones, and you could hear it, and it wasn't
Yes.
cut out to just leave the music be presented in a clear and professional way. It was like you were there in this wonderful room with a bunch of musicians that had been playing the night before, and we're in here to have a good time playing some of Muddy's old and new music together, and I think that's what we got.
It's exactly what you got. It comes across very much as a bunch of musicians just having a good time. It really does. Now, in addition to the 14 albums that you've personally recorded by my count, you've also appeared on one with Johnny and six with Muddy as part of his band. That's quite a body of work, I'm sure you would agree. Talk about the album that you recorded with Johnny just a little bit. He was some kind of powerhouse, wasn't he?
Johnny Winter was a very powerful musician. And after we had done a tour after the Hard Again album and the band was really tight from having worked a couple of months of gigs, he said, let's go right in the studio and make an album for me. And he knew what he wanted to play and he knew how to lead the band. A couple of times he said to me, here, you count off the songs so I can really concentrate on the singing and playing and kind of lead people through the cues and stuff. And I did that, but it was a wonderful album called Nothing But the Blues.
Nice, nice. Now, if you had to choose, since we've only got one album to talk about with Johnny, if you had to choose just one album working with Muddy, what would your favorite be and why?
I'm not good with questions about favorites.
Okay.
Because just because I like a particular one doesn't mean the other ones ain't shit. People are always looking for a shortcut to get, I want the best, and then I'll get the best, and then I'll be the best. No, it doesn't work like that. I don't think, anyway. It doesn't work like that. For me, they're all good. I couldn't compare, say, the Woodstock album from 1975 to Hard Again in 1976. They were both amazing experiences for me, and I think the music on each of them, which was made by musicians that were older than me and were well known, but were still younger than Muddy, and they wanted to showcase Muddy and do everything they could for him. Both of those albums were really fine, and I wouldn't say, go to this one. This is where you'll get all the good stuff and the other ones don't matter or don't just aren't as important. Well, life's more complicated than that, I think.
Yes, sir. In your ebook, Steady Rollin', you talk about leaving Muddy's band in 1980. Now, actually, the entire band left over business matters, yet you all remained friends until he passed in 1983. That certainly says a lot about Muddy and you all, doesn't it?
We were on the road like a family for many, many years. Some of them were there from way before I was. Some of them, Pinetop Perkins had been with them since 1969 or so when Otis Spann left Muddy's band on piano. Willie Big Eye Smith and Calvin Fuzz Jones, the rhythm section, had been with Muddy in the 60s and were really a lot of the foundation and of his band sound. And they being around those wonderful musicians was a thrill for me, and that's kind of learning how to fit in with that really, really worked well.
Yes, sir. Do you remember your last conversation with Muddy, and if you do, would you like to share any of that with us?
Well, the last time that I saw him alive was in November of 1980, 6 months after I had left Muddy's band. And my band opened a show for him at a club called The Bayou in Washington, D.C. And I was very aware when I was playing my opening set that Muddy was at the other end of the building back in the dressing room, but that he could hear what I was doing, and I wanted to play something that he would like and enjoy. I played a lot of traditional blues, which is most of what I was playing 6 months into having my own band anyway. We did real well. I lived in D.C., and a lot of people knew me, and they gave me an encore. And I played a song that came out in 1949 called I Just Keep Loving Her, by the harmonica player Little Walter, who had been in Muddy's band from, I guess, about 1949 or 1950, when Muddy and Little Walter and Jimmy Rogers used to play together with a drummer even before they got Otis Spann on piano. And but I played that song, and when I came back into the dressing room, Muddy got up off of the couch, which is something he didn't usually do, and he came over and he put his hands on my shoulders and he said, "I haven't heard that song in 30 years. You're keeping the old school alive." Well, that's the nicest thing he ever said to me,
Yes, I bet.
or the most meaningful thing. And I was 30 years old. I was very deliberately playing a song that came out when I did, and but one that would be meaningful to both of us. And after that, I stayed in the room and talked with him. And as his band and my band were back in the club packing up the equipment after the gig, I was alone in the dressing room with him and got to have one of the deepest conversations I ever had, because I did talk about how the band had broken up. And it was a sad conversation, and he was sad about it too. But it wasn't the last time that I ever spoke to him. I would call him about every 3 weeks until April 4th of 1983, which was his birthday, but it's the last one that he celebrated with us. And I spoke to him, and he did not sound strong on the phone. I asked him how he's doing. He said he was having good and bad days. He was fighting lung cancer and a heart condition. He had quit smoking cigarettes about the time I joined the band in 1973, on advice of his doctor, who said you need to lower your blood pressure. And he did those things, but eventually, heart condition and lung cancer took him anyway. And that was just during the conversation, I asked Muddy, "Do you ever pick up your guitar now that you're home and off the road, just to play it?" And he goes, "No, I've been playing 50 years. It's there." And that just kind of
Wow.
blew me away to think about that perspective. But he was a thoughtful person, and he understood himself real well.
Yeah.
So, somehow, without thinking about it, the last thing that I said to him, instead of just goodbye, I said, "Be strong." And 3 weeks later, got the phone call that he had passed,
Man.
which was April 30th, 1983.
Bob, you also spoke very highly of Pine Top Perkins and his youthful exuberance, even at the age of 90. I would love to hear a little bit more about him as well.
Well, while we were in Muddy's band together, he was the oldest and I was the youngest, but we had a musical bond. And for me, I wanted to take the opportunity to make his life easier as a friend. And even though he was younger than I am now, but that was a long time ago, I would hang with him after the shows were over. The rest of the band would go maybe back to the hotel and hang out, but we'd find some place where someone was playing and go sit in and close down the club. And so
With your penchant for stories, do you have any favorite Pine Top stories you can share?
the fact that he was born in 1913 and I was born like 35, 36 years later, I just wanted to be close to him, help him in every way I could, aside from the amazing thrill of playing old blues with Pine Top. And when we were in Muddy's band together, I usually the stage set up and where they put the piano permitted. I usually was on the same side of the stage as Pinetop, right between him and Muddy. And hearing Muddy Waters play on one side and sing and Pinetop's piano on the other side, it was blues was raining down on me. I'm still soaked. I just
There you go.
loved that music, and it was a I was in a place to do it that you just couldn't, literally couldn't get it anywhere else.
Right.
No, not, and I fully appreciated it in the moment, right from the very start of the time, right up till today, and probably will, it'll probably mean even more to me tomorrow.
Well, speaking of Pine Top, I have to tell you, I'm a huge fan of the work that you've done and continue to do with the Pine Top Perkins Foundation as the musical director of the Pine Top Perkins Workshop Experience. Would you please share some details on this annual event in Clarksdale?
In 2010, Pinetop's manager, Patricia Morgan, helped fulfill a wish of his, which was to conceive and begin this foundation. And the goal of it was to have piano workshops for young people. We very quickly found we could only attract 5 or 6 people, which wasn't enough to have to set up an event and do it. And I said, well, if you add blues guitar to the workshops, we'll get plenty of people. And I can teach that. I have some experience with doing workshops. I'd done those at Jorma Kaukonen's Fur Peace Ranch and a few other places, and so we did that, and it grew from 2010 when Pinetop was actually there to see it. He didn't actually teach it, but he was there and inspired everybody.
That's cool.
But it was very cool, and then he passed the next year before the second workshops. But on those second workshops, we started getting more and more young people, and it grew into a real family. Say on that second year, one of the local young musicians from Clarksdale started with us in 2011, and that was Kingfish, who was 11 at the time,
Yes, sir. Man.
and was in some of our early classes. But we had what was so beautiful, especially in light of today's times, is that it was all kinds of people, all ages, all races, all getting together over this soulful blues music, which is reflects our own humanity, which is why that music is so attractive to soulful people. And it was the world as it should be, of
Yes.
people working together and being friends and becoming a family over blues that we love. And at this point, in 2025, the Pinetop Perkins Foundation is going stronger than ever. And it is beautiful to see what happens among the young people that love the music.
And
And
you just had Young Rel down there this past year, didn't you?
last couple of years.
Okay. What is it like, Bob, looking at this kid? You know, he's still a kid, but what is it like to look at him and see what's coming down the road with the next generation? I mean, he's amazing.
It was completely obvious that everything was going to happen 2 to 3 years ago when he started putting up videos on Facebook and probably TikTok from home of himself playing and learning as he went. And it was obvious that he had the talent that he does have and could
Yes.
get as good as he is now. And it's also obvious it's going to go a whole lot farther. It's nice that
Yes,
he's
sir.
recognized right now, but everybody was encouraging him and was friendly to him, and he came to our classes. I guess he's done it 3 times now, because
The first
he
time as a
start.
student?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, now he kind of is what we call an intern, which assists the teacher in the classes. But say he plays harmonica and guitar in the harmonica
Yes.
classes. He would play a lot of guitar with the other harmonica players playing too. Everybody just finds their own role, and it's pretty cool and sweet. But it's a thrill to watch somebody that is so talented that doesn't feel like they have to go beyond traditional music. He just plays it deeper and deeper, and it's wonderful to hear it.
It's
We're
amazing.
thrilled about Young Rel.
It's amazing to me because you see a lot of today's next generation coming up, DK Harrell, Christone Kingfish, Matthias Lateen, all talented, very talented musicians. But they lend themselves to some of the newer music as well. It seems like Young Rel's kind of staying in that lane. And people are coming to him because they're finding that he's bringing something for you, for example, this is your love. This is your passion, you know? And I happen to think that the blues is in a good place right now. And I think that we've got a good future ahead of us. What do you think?
I used to be, and a lot of people used to be, worried about keeping the blues alive.
Yes, sir.
And as a matter of fact, during the early time that I was in Muddy Waters' band, he said to me that it bothered him a lot that the kids and grandkids that lived in his house would did not listen to his music very much. They were listening to whatever was on the radio, and we would hear in, say, 1974, Smoking in the Boys' Room on the radio, and Barry White was on there, which Muddy told me he didn't enjoy that.
Okay.
He said, "I don't like to talk about bad about any musician, but I hate Barry White, and I bet he hates me." Those were Muddy's exact words. So I never told anybody.
Till just
Yeah.
now.
Yeah. And but he, I'm sure he didn't like a lot of other things even more. But he said that he felt badly that young African American musicians were not carrying on what he called the old school. And I think that kind of really broke his heart, but all he could do was be Muddy Waters and play it himself. But the way things have worked out with the developments you've been talking about of this generation,
Yes.
50 years later, that is, a lot of them are going to be around at the end of this century. Amen.
Yes, sir.
And I think the keeping the blues alive thing is not a issue anymore. I think it is alive. It's going to be alive. And not just from people who reject mixing it with rock music or finding their own way to express it, but the traditional players too.
Yeah.
It's all there, and it's being done on a very high level. You mentioned a lot of the people that are doing it.
Yes. And I think that if we can all come together and agree, the blues is a buffet. You take what you want and you're satisfied and move on. You don't have to judge anybody else because my music's better than your music. I think those people do more to discredit the blues than to build the blues. I just happen to feel that the blues is going to continue to have a good future as long as we nourish it, as long as we keep supporting people like Young Rel and Chris Stone and Mathias and Jovan Webb. Holy crap. You know, I mean, I love this new generation, but Bob, looking back at your years of playing with Muddy, Pine Top, Johnny, and Paul, just to name a few of the many, how do you feel those experiences with these top shelf musicians helped to mold and shape your own work through the years?
Well, my own goal with my own music is simply in the moment, and to be able to look back on it is to just do my very best, to play my very deepest with the musical values that I learned through those wonderful experiences of being in Muddy's band and on the bandstand with him, and then all the years since then, from 1980 till now, I've done probably thousands of shows that I've led, either with my own band or in situations where I'm put together with other musicians. And that's an opportunity to me, but I just aim at playing my best and deepest blues right in the moment. Whatever's happening now, here tonight. I
Yes, sir.
did an acoustic album, has a song on it. So all I know that's right is this guitar and tonight. And I am very focused on just making my best music in the moment and trying to conceive it and write it when I make a song.
Yes, sir. Now, before we wrap up here, I want to go back to our first chat in season two when I ask you for the origin of your nickname. You very dutifully told me all about how you got Steady Rolling Bob Margolin. But I had a listener recently comment and recommend that I occasionally add stories like yours to this program. He feels a nice educational piece would be a part of this, and I agree. So I did some homework, and I'm betting money you already know the origin of Muddy Waters, correct?
Of his name?
His nickname, yeah, Muddy
Nickname.
Waters.
Yeah, he got asked that all the time. All the time.
Yeah. So here's what I found. I want you to know I did my homework. McKinley Morganfield was raised by his grandmother in the Stovall Plantation near Clarksdale, Mississippi. As a young child, he loved to play in the mud and murky water of a nearby creek. His grandmother, Della Grant, noticed his fondness for the muddy water and affectionately nicknamed him Muddy. After receiving the nickname, his childhood friends began calling him Muddy Water. And later the S was added, resulting in Muddy Waters. And there you have it. That's our first installment of What's in a Name. And I appreciate you very much for helping me on that. But Bob, what's the future hold for you at this time, sir? Any new albums on the horizon or anything fun you want to talk about?
No, actually, I've been off the road for about a year now.
Okay.
I had a very, very busy summer, and after that, I have just been home since about, oh, beginning of October or
Okay.
so, and I am really loving doing that. And
You've earned it.
I have, and it's kind of a seen it, done it, been there as far as being on the road. Aside from the fact that it's super uncomfortable these days, it's also dangerous and harder than ever to make the plans, and it's harder than ever to do business. And I've just enjoyed staying home with my wife and two dogs and a cat in a little house in the forest. And I'm having a ball here, but I'm enjoying doing interviews like this one, which I'll thank you for so you don't get away without it.
Thank you.
And also being able to put my stories up on Facebook. And it's different from writing a book, which I've done before, but because if I post something on Facebook, very quickly people are responding and commenting and telling their own stories. And that's kind of it's a new way to relate to an audience. And I enjoy that very much these days.
Well, you're definitely engaging people. There's a lot of times that I will copy and paste your stories onto my page. You always get credit, but I love some of these stories that you put out there because, number one, I didn't get involved in the blues until later in life. I was always appreciative of the genre, Raised around it by my mom a little bit when I was younger. As a matter of fact, I had the pleasure of sending her to see B.B. King for her birthday one year. And my one regret in life is she asked me if I wanted to go with her. And I said, you know, Mom, I said, I'll go next time. And there was no next time. So I learned a valuable lesson there. But I enjoy the stories that you put up. Please keep doing it. And I'll keep enjoying it and keep sharing them, definitely. But Bob, this is
I
the portion.
appreciate it.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just thanking you.
This is the portion of the interview where I ask where you would like people to go and learn more about you and your music, maybe buy some CDs or merch. And obviously, you don't want to be booked for a gig right now because you're enjoying the home life. So, where can they go to get the other information?
I don't even think about selling it these days. I don't have any commercial information. I don't sell CDs through my website. I did during the pandemic, and I hated doing the mailing and putting everything together and keeping up with postage and stamps and everything. I hated it so much. I said I'll just let people get them however they get them or not. Who I am, I just don't want to do that. So, my music, if people actually want to buy it rather than stream it, I would go to a website called Vistone.com, which is the Vistone label group. I'm a partner in that, and I put out my albums on that. So at Vistone.com, you could probably find me with a few clicks.
Okay, well, we'll make sure to put the link up there. Steady rolling, Bob Margolin. I want to thank you for taking time once again to share some great stories with us here on Time Signatures. As always, I appreciate your good humor, and I look forward to seeing you around the state of Michigan, maybe sometime soon if you travel. If not, maybe I'll get to see you somewhere else, but all the best to you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me here. I appreciate you.
All right, I appreciate you, sir. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Bob Margolin, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham. Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.